come to class next Sunday at 9:30 a.m. in the E Wing. Thank you.
I'm ready.
Crowd is going to be bigger this time, the way the word is spreading.
We've been advertising something that might not happen.
What if we've all been misled?
His obsession with reforming God's immutable law will be exposed. I want my people to participate in the healing of the world. If not now,
when?
Master, it's time.
So this week I went away for a few days and read to prepare for the coming series, which is something I've done for like the last 15 years. It's a very helpful practice to get away and plan and pray and prepare. The problem is when I'm away, I'm on my own. So about 7 or 8 years ago, I was on one of these little study summits, and I had made myself a sandwich, and I ate like half of the sandwich, and I was like, that's something's off about that. And then I opened it up, and I realized I had not taken the plastic off the cheese. So I'd eaten like half a sandwich, just a straight up plastic on the cheese. And that was I did that twice in that week. That's the sad side. It's not good for man to be alone. So I recently came across the obituary of the guy who actually invented that plastic that goes on the slice of cheese. His name was Victor Dorman. He lived to be 80. He died in Florida. And he got an obituary in the New York Times because he revolutionized the cheese industry. And I appreciate that, you know, plastic on the cheese as much as anybody, but do you want to be known for that? I mean, that's what he was known for. That's all it said about him in the New York Times. He was a successful businessman, and maybe he was a wonderful person, but when you look at your life on earth, what do you want to be known for? David Brooks, columnist for the Times, actually has written several books where he talks about, and this is a really insightful observation, there is a difference between the values that we have in our life. He calls one of them the resume values. These are the values that you put on your resume to get the job, to get hired, so that when you walk into a room or when you meet someone new, they don't look down on you. Or maybe you can look down on them. These are those kind of values, resume values. But then he talks about the other kind of values, the deeper values, the eulogy values, the kind of values that you want to be known for after your life is over. And as someone, eulogy is just a Greek word that means a good word. As someone who has preached a lot of funerals and spoken a lot of good words, one of the things I can tell you, David Brooks is right, there's almost no overlap between resume values and eulogy values. That is the stuff that you really want, the stuff you want, your deepest values, and what we spend our lives pursuing. And one of the things that's so ironic, and maybe this is just America, but it is everywhere, and it's a temptation in my own life. The way you spend your days is, of course, the way you're going to spend your life. And one of the biggest challenges that we face is that we all have these kind of noble aspirations and convictions, and yet our commitments rarely match our convictions. So we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew for the last 9 months, and today is the last sermon on the Gospel of Matthew. I hope as long as God allows me to preach, I will preach through a gospel every 2 or 3 years, because we religious people, we drift, don't we? It is important to keep the main thing the main thing. That's why the very first piece of our vision is follow Jesus. Because here's what I know about religious people. If we don't keep the center, we start arguing about stuff that's not central. right? What color to paint this, what songs we do or do not want sung, or what, and we are passionate over time, we'll become passionate about boundaries and we forget what the center is. Well, Matthew's gospel has been great for us, at least for me, because it has more face time with Jesus than any other gospel, more red letters, more of Jesus's teaching. It was a manual for the first few hundred years of church history. For the early Christians, it was a manual of discipleship. This stuff, and they would actually, this is what it means to follow Jesus. And they would read this stuff and they would actually do it. They would not read Jesus say, when you got to forgive 70 times seven, and they would not read that and say, now, what do you think he meant actually? No, they would do it. When Jesus talks about when you fast from food, they would read that and they would think, now what's the Greek word for fasting? No, they would actually fast from food. Some of us think that means fast food. No, it means fasting from food, because they actually followed him on this. And by the way, Jesus isn't just giving good information here. If he's the King of Kings, he's giving orders. If you bend your knee to him in baptism, if you have pledged your allegiance to him in baptism, he's giving you orders. But because of the kind of king he is, he's also giving you choices. Have you noticed how many choices are in the Gospel of Matthew? Do you want the easy or the hard yoke? Do you want to build your house on sand or on rock? Do you want to take the narrow or the wide path? Do you want to get in or stay out of the boat? And one of the reasons I love Matthew's gospel is because it's a wisdom gospel. Now, for most of us, we don't understand what wisdom is. We think wisdom is being smart or having an intelligence. It's not. What wisdom is looking ahead, paying attention to the path that you're on, and being honest with yourself about that path. Because self-deception comes easy to everybody. Wisdom is looking ahead and having the courage to make adjustments if you don't like the direction your life is ultimately headed. So over and over again, Jesus is letting us know what will happen if we let our lives go in one direction or another. The house will crumble. The tree will either bear fruit or it will get thrown into the fire. One road leads to destruction and the other to life. And in the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we began actually with the end of the Sermon on the Mount with the houses that fall. But right before that, he says this: not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, this is Matthew 7:21, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Now that is a strong word. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord. And these are people who thought they were going to be with them forever. And they're evildoers and they didn't know it. They thought they were doing well. They had quite the resume for God. You know, I have been walking alongside people who have lost their faith in Jesus for the last 20 years. And, you know, there's all kinds of reasons why they do that. A lot of times it's suffering. And ironically, rarely their own suffering. It's watching suffering of other people. Sometimes the problems are intellectual. But if I was to say one thing, the biggest barrier for them, it was us. And what I mean by that is people who say they follow Jesus that don't look very much like Jesus. And one of the challenges Jesus is saying here is, it's not everybody who says, Lord, Lord. Not everybody who says, listen, I vote my Christian values. Not everybody who says, look, I come to church. Not everybody who, it's the people. Do you catch that? And then he's going to say it later. Everybody who puts these words of mine into practice. What an interesting way to end this Christian manifesto or way of being human. Jesus had a yoke. All rabbis in the first century had a yoke. It's a set of teachings. It's a way of life. It's not just teachings. It's a way to live in this life. It's a weird image for us because we don't live in an agrarian society, but a yoke is what you'd put on oxen, and it was a path. It was a direction. It was letting you know. And every rabbi had a yoke. The thing that was different about Jesus's is that his yoke was easy, or it made life, not like the absence of difficulty, but it made life good. His yoke gave you rest. And second, Jesus had apprentices. Like we talked about when we first started talking about Matthew, the word that we use, discipleship, is a really good word, or disciple, but a better word for us, because disciple has become such a churchy word that you compartmentalize to something you do on Sunday morning. A better word is apprentice. Like, learn to take on the practices of Jesus. To be one of the followers of Jesus in the first century would have meant three things. It would have meant to be with Jesus, to become like Jesus, and to live like him. To do your life as if he would do your life if he was living it. The whole point of apprenticeship is to model your life after Jesus and to recover your soul. That word salvation, we think of it, we think of religious words like, getting saved from hell or whatever. But the word salvation is the exact same word for healing. So when you see in the Gospels that Jesus saves someone, and then in the next chapter he heals someone, it's the same word. The word salvation comes from the salve, like medicine. And it's an ointment you put on a burn or a wound. So when we think of following Jesus, we think, and this is a mistake, I think, we think of, loving our enemies. We think of going the extra mile or turning the other cheek or suffering patiently and hopefully. And then we live like everybody else. And by the way, I don't know if you've noticed this in your own life, but it doesn't work. Because when somebody punches you, if you've been wronged and you live like everybody else, then when the time comes for you to draw down on those resources, you don't got them. And so you respond like everybody else. I think the American, if you want to experience the life of Jesus, we need to adopt the lifestyle of Jesus. And we've lost that in America. America church is mostly knowledge, which is great. We have a lot of knowledge. But our obedience has been outpaced by our information. And one of the things that Jesus is calling us to do is not just a set of ideas or a list of do's and don'ts. It's that, but it's more than that. It's a way of life based on Jesus himself. So if you were to think about the way Jesus talks about it, or the way early Christians talked about following Jesus, they were a way. They called it the way. Because this was a set of, it was a lifestyle. If you want to enjoy the life that Jesus is calling us to, you don't have to just adopt his theology and his ethics, but his lifestyle. So take his habits and practices as your own. And by the way, like, Jesus took naps. I mean, right? That's good, right? You can follow Jesus. Take a nap. Most of what we know from Jesus' life come from the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if you were to consider not just Jesus' teaching, because he is considered by a lot of people a teacher, but his Gospels are a biography. Now listen, here's what I know about you. Maybe for you, people that you've admired in your life, you've read their biography. Maybe for you it was Steve Jobs or Bill Clinton because he's an Arkansan or whatever. But here, if you really admired them, if you wanted to be like them, here's what you did. You did some of the stuff they did. Like you, if they took a nap, you took a nap. If they went to that law school and you wanted to be like them, you went to that law school. If they got up early in the morning and did their work, you did that kind of stuff. What if you would read the Gospels like that? What if you tried to make some of Jesus' habits your habits? Because those little details actually might add up to something. Very few people read the Gospels that way. And it's not like, hey, this is legalism, you got to do this. Actually, that's the road that leads to death, because those habits, those practices of Jesus are not an end in themselves. They're a way to be with, become like, and live like Jesus. So that's when the spiritual disciplines go wrong, when you start thinking, all right, I'm going to do this and everything's going to be okay. You know, if I read my Bible, you know, if I do prayer and Sabbath or whatever, which Jesus never commands anything but prayer in these practices. But the way he did it was he rested on the Sabbath. He didn't rest like the legalists did. He prayed. He got away. He took naps. He did not constantly give in to the incessant demands of the people around him. Now, here's the thing. The most common metaphor in the New Testament for becoming someone different than you currently are is athletics. And everybody in this room probably gets it, because there are things that you could not do right now if your life depended on it, but that you could probably do if you practiced. So let's say, for example, that you want to bench press like your own body weight. There are some of us in this room who couldn't do that no matter if their children's lives were at stake. But here's what you could do. You could probably wake up tomorrow morning and do 5 or 10 push-ups. And then the next day, the same. And by the end of the week, you might even be able to do 20. Or by the end of the month, you might even be able to do 30 or 40. And over time, you would gain access to power that is readily available to you, because your human body is able to do this. And you would become the kind of person who could do these kind of things. Now, here's the reason I'm bringing this. Every day of our life, you already are practicing. All of us, every day of our life, are practicing something. We have very little idea how much our daily habits are forming us. And as someone who sits on the consequent side of the equation, as someone who gets invited into people's lives when things go really, really badly, and I'm it's such holy ground. I'm so grateful for the calling God has given me to get to do that. But wouldn't you like to know before that, that the stuff that you do, from what kind of news you watch, to what kind of things you listen to or don't listen to when you're driving, to how you spend your off time, your weekends, to your bedtime routine, to your morning routine, to the people that you decide to share life with. All of those things are ways of practicing, and eventually, and this is what Jesus is saying all through Matthew with his wisdom, pay attention, because what you're practicing is eventually going to pay off. You're building something. All of us are. And how would your life be different if you actually redirected your attention to those practicing intentionally the way of Jesus? Now, if the status quo works for you, then you don't need to hear this. But for some of you, there's a deep hunger. This kind of life, or you, maybe you see trouble coming. If you're wise and you're paying attention, you see trouble coming. About 12 years ago, actually, a little over 12 years ago, I was pretty significantly overweight. I was working in Fort Worth, and Leslie was pregnant with Samuel, and she was like really pregnant. She was in the third trimester, the you did this to me phase of pregnancy, and Eden is just a couple of years old, and Eden walks up to me one day and puts her hand on my stomach and goes, "Hi, baby brother." And I started working out, because that was rock bottom for me. But here's the good news about rock bottom. That's when you hit the rock. If you're a Jesus follower, it's when you can hit the rock. If you discovered, if you've got this nagging feeling that your life isn't what it ought to be, that bad habits turn into an addiction, and the anger problem that you saw in your mom growing up, you're beginning to see in the mirror part, or you just have a great sense of anxiety that you just carry around, or the relationships in your life are falling apart, or you just have a general sense of unhappiness, then take Jesus seriously here. It's not just attend church as important as that is, because Jesus attended synagogue. It's not just be a part of a life group, as important that, as that is. In fact, that's a really important thing that actually can help you adopt these other practices. It's following Jesus in your actual habits in your life. And not as just as a means of grace. Like you're noticing, I'm not intentionally telling you certain kinds of habits to read the Gospel of Matthew for yourself. Notice what Jesus does. Jesus is the most influential person in human history, and the next 50 people don't even compare. He split history in two. He's the most unique and compelling person who has ever lived, but he's not just a historical person of the past. He's a living reality to be encountered now. Billions of people throughout history and today have acknowledged him as the King of Kings. And for many of them, this is not just a private religious affirmation. It's the center of their life. He changed them. And if you're willing and ready, he can change you. I see this so much. Religious people, if you grew up in it, you're so used to it, you forgot what Jesus has or can save you from. One of the great things about Matthew's gospel is he's trying to teach you very practical things on wisdom on how to live your life, how not to be anxious, which we talked about a few weeks ago. Like, it's really simple. Be grateful. Gratitude and anxiety cannot coexist. Look at what God has done in the past and what God is doing around. Tune your attentions to that, and your anxiety levels will decrease. He's trying to teach us how to treat and see women, how to see the men and around us and women and honor them as who God made them to be. Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew is trying to get you to be self-aware because he knows how self-deceptive we are. So like Matthew 18, Jesus is over and over again paying attention, trying to get you to pay attention to the way you engage things like conflict even. Make sure in Matthew 7, look at your own life before you judge. Jesus is trying to give us incredibly practical ways, habits of how to become like him. And because we grew up in the Bible Belt, or we're cultural Christians, or our parents or grandparents were, which, by the way, is quickly fading, Jesus is kind of just familiar, kind of a warm blanket. But being a disciple, taking on his yoke or way of life, is hard, at least for us, for the simple reason that Jesus will run your life, at least the life you had planned. Because Jesus isn't trying to get invited into your life. He's trying to invite you into his. And that's a different thing. He's not following you. If you're a disciple, you're called to follow him. And the good news is you really can. You really can become these kinds of people. Non-anxious people who don't have enemies, or at least enemies that are human. You be the kind of people who are filled with love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and self-control. Can you imagine being that person? I know when we come to church, we're all, good and fine, but can you imagine in the heat of the moment when your spouse says something, not blowing up? Or when your kids are irritating you or whatever, and you become the kind of person who turns away a harsh answer with a gentle word? Can you imagine in moments of great anxiety and even despair having hope? These kind of things are really possible. Billions of people have discovered this, or maybe millions. But it takes, in the words of Jesus, practice. It takes a choice. And Matthew's all about choices and paying attention to the direction those choices are leading you to. Jesus wants you to pay attention to the world you are in and the way that you have chosen it. Okay, so in the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, the wise men in the Gospel, the dominant story is they go to Jerusalem because there's a star and they're looking for the new king. Problem is, there's an old king. And the old king's kind of good at being king. And he's really nervous about this rumor. That there's a new baby king. Herod the Great is the king. He looks kingly. He's got all the stuff. And he tells the wise men, hey, listen, I also want to worship this king. So if you could, why don't you tell me about where he is? And so Matthew tells us these wise men go and find the baby king. And they have to make a choice. Which reality am I going to pay attention to? The dominant one? The one that this guy who's king, who can kill us, says? Or this little baby born in a cave? Flash forward, 30 years and 13 chapters, and this baby king is all grown up. And he tells a parable that I think is fascinating. In Matthew chapter 13, he says this. 13, starting in verse 44, he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it." So Jesus is saying this guy stumbles upon treasure in the field. And think about this guy. By the way, this is common back in the day. They don't have banks on every corner, so people would, they would dig a hole and they would bury their money there. And then sometimes those people would die. And so the land would be sold. So this guy has a chance of a lifetime to cash in on something that nobody else knows. Okay, I think 9 years ago, in California, something happened in February 2013 where this couple was walking along in this land that they owned, and they kicked something hard, and they saw it was a coffee can. And they dug around it, and they saw this. This is all kinds of gold, $10 coins from the 18th century. It's called the Saddle Ridge thing. If you could go to the next one. They found hundreds of maybe thousands of these, worth millions, the biggest buried treasure ever found in America. They found 8 cans on their property, and it was worth over $10 million. I grew up in Central Arkansas with Ponce de Leon rumors. Anybody hear that? Anybody say, okay. And what was Ponce de Leon looking for? Fountain of Youth. Yeah, so I would like look around because I thought maybe I'd get that for mom and make her a little less cranky, shave some years off her or whatever. But we dream of finding treasure, right? And this is Jesus using one of my favorite metaphors, because he's saying it's all around you. You're just not looking hard enough. Okay, Churches of Christ, we are related to Amish people. And we're like, distant cousins to the Amish. And one of the practices that I love the most about the Amish is what they call Rumspringer. When you were born, you are not Amish. If you're born to an Amish family, if you're an Amish teenager, you're not Amish. You're not Amish until after Rumspringer. Does anybody know anybody heard of that? Okay, a few people have heard of Rumspringer. Here's what it is. When you're 18 years old, they kick you out. You go live a year outside of the Amish community, and you do whatever you want to do. This is where we get the phrase, sowing your wild oats. That's right. And then, if you choose to come back, and by the way, every night at the dinner table, they set your empty chair a plate because you're missed. But if you choose to come back from that day on, you're Amish. It's one of the reasons why we practice baptism, not as babies, but as adults. Because it's something that you choose. The way of Jesus cannot be compelled. You can't vote it in. You can't force it in. That's what I mean when I say we're distant cousins. The kingdom of God cannot be compelled. It must be chosen. Parents, your kids will follow your choices. Your real guy. Tell them are important to you, the ones you really made. And I want you to think about this guy. He's taking a risk. Because what if it's fake gold? What if he goes and sells everything he has and the treasure's gone when he gets back? In order to do this, he's got to liquidate all his assets, break the bank. And what if it turns out the pearls are fake or whatever? But his overwhelming response is not anxiety, it is joy. And that brings me back to those wise men. When they find the baby Jesus, because they choose wisely. They don't go back to Herod the Great. They find the baby Jesus, and when they see him, they are overwhelming response is joy. When the women in the end of the Gospel of Matthew see that Jesus is risen, they don't know what to make of it. Nobody ever expected anything like this, but their overwhelming response is joy. That's what the story of Matthew is trying to say. It's a point Matthew's making all throughout his Gospels. There is a lot of intelligent-sounding reasons why the stuff Jesus says sounds out of tune with reality. You can explain him away pretty effectively, and I think actually our modern world has become pretty efficient at doing so. But for those with ears to hear, this is an invitation to a different reality, one that will cost you everything and is worth every cent. Because as the wise men found out, as the disciples found out, Jesus is the pearl of great price. And he's worth the risk. The point of Matthew's gospel is not what you should do. It's never been that. It's this is what's been done. You want in on this or not? The point of Matthew's gospel, before it's anything, a manual of discipleship or anything, is the great story of God doing for you what you could not do for yourself. It's the great rescue story. Because if someone's drowning, you don't throw them a manual to learn how to swim. You jump in. And that's what the story of Matthew is saying. This is who Jesus is. This is a manual of discipleship, but it's not what came first. What came first was the rescue. This isn't a story about what you should do. It's about what God is up to. So don't miss out. So what do you say? Yes or no? Buy or sell? Every day is a chance. Every hour is an opportunity. Every moment of your life is a precious gift. How will you spend yours? So this is a preview for what we're going to be doing next week as we answer that question as a church. In the last book of the Bible, Jesus talks directly to seven churches. But what's interesting is he's not talking to individual churches. He's talking to the cities those churches are in, to the church at Ephesus, to the church at Laodicea, to the church at Sardis. When Paul writes letters in the New Testament, he's not writing to individual churches on street corners. He's writing to the church of the city. History is more than just a bunch of facts. It's more than just a bunch of times and dates. It's what men and women do with their one and only God-given life. There's a time in the book of Acts where a church planter named Paul stands up and says, God has ordained the times and places that people should live. Here's what that means. That you didn't get to pick where and when you would be born. That was God's gift to you. But what you do with your one God-given life is your gift back to God. You know what's interesting about those ancient cities? The cities in the first century that would have been known as the most immoral, pagan, evil cities in the world. These days you don't know those cities because of how evil they were. You know them because they're names of letters in the New Testament. Because the gospel changes cities. It still can. It still does. So that's next Sunday as we kind of kick fall back off. And you make your choices. So what do you say? Yes or no?